Morning, people. My name is Trevor Robinson. I'm the chair of this hearing panel. Just introduce everybody you have in front of you. On my far left, Commissioner Smith. Then,
Introducing ourselves.
Introduce yourself.
Okay. Quentin Smith. I'm a councillor, elected member with the Queenstown Lakes District Council for the Wanaka Ward and commissioner.
Hello, I'm Ian Munro. I'm an urban designer from Auckland.
Hello, I'm Sarah Dawson. I'm a planner from Christchurch and the Hearings Commissioner, and I sat on part of the Stage 2 hearings in 2018.
Good morning, Lorena Greg Hill. I'm a independent Hearings Commissioner and a planner from Tangaki Makaurau, Auckland, and I was involved in the ski subzones of Stage 1.
Mariora. Apologies about the Scottish accent. Name's Callum MacLeod, councillor, deputy mayor of this fine district. I've been involved in a bit too many other PDP hearings, so there you go.
And I'm a lawyer from Wellington, but originally hailing from Invercargill, so this is close to home territory. Kat, you could talk to us about health and safety. Well, we're here to hear submissions on Stage 3 and Stage 3B of the proposed district plan for Queenstown Lakes. We pre-arranged that before the council gets underway, Mr. Allison will give us a brief address on behalf of Mana Whenua. So I'd invite Mr. Allison to step forward to the front desk and talk to us, give us a high-level introduction.
Tēnā rā koutou katoa, ka nui ngā mihi atu ki koutou, e raurapa tērā mā, a hākoi, hākoro, kai atu ki ngā tamariki huri no tēnei pari, a tēnā rā koutou, ngā mihi atu ki koutou no tō mihi atu ki tātou, i tō te nei. I kau ea mai o tātou nei kāro Panganui, tēnei tēnei kaupapa, ka haere tēnei māheri, tēnei nui, ngā mihi atu ki koutou katoa. Welcome to Queenstown, those of you who have come. Thank you for the greetings. We're pleased to be here today to talk about our tupuna associations, the Queenstown Lakes District Council area. I've briefly given you a mihi to you, sir, commissioners, ladies and gentlemen, greetings, and everyone assembled today. But before I proceed with the presentation, I'd like to do our karakia with this part of the hearing, given that you're going to be hearing the important parts of it talking to us, and your association with this part of our tribal takiwha. So, whakarumi up now ki te tangi a te mani nei. Tui a i rongo, tui a i rao, tui a i rongo. here tangata. Karamuta ko, karamuta ao. Tioia ita muka takata, takia mai, a waipi nui, a waipi o, a waipi pamama. I te whae ao ki te ao marama, whāno, whāno, harama i te toki, haumi e, hui e, tāiki e, kura tātou. I'll be seated to go through the PowerPoint. We have about 25 slides that I've got to go through to give you an overview of the Tupuna associations with this area. So that slide there is from the writings of our esteemed ancestor who learned to write. He was taught by the first Christian missionaries. He was one of those ancestors, generally were the sons of chiefs who were invited into special schools of learning to learn our histories, traditions, and all things important to our people. Not everyone learned those, it was only a special class. He learned to write, and he wrote that down from those learnings. Te Ra Moirehu, he wrote that at Moiraki on the Otago coast. And so that's what he's saying there. He really likened it to a waiata of the demigods who were singing the traditions of the landscape. It described the creation right from the time of creation. So it starts from a time of darkness, great void of nothingness, and in time there was this ancestor, I suppose, or demigod really, Maku, who mated with Mahuru Nui Atia, and that's when water arrived. It came out of darkness into light, into water. And then Papatua Nuku and Takaroa, and this is a distinctive Ngaitahu kōrero only, and that Papatua Nuku's first husband was Takaroa, and they had children. Takaroa left for a long period of time, and so Papatua Nuku became lonely and met Raki Nui, which is the common story about Godfather and Earth Mother, and they had many children, as many as 80, and some of those children conspired to separate their parents to let the light in, so our life could grow. Of those 80 children, there were some dominant ones, as is always the case in any family, and these particular ones took an interest in human affairs. You'll be familiar with some of them: Tāne, god of forest, birds; Tumatoweka, god of war; Rongo, peace; Haumie, tiki tiki of fern roots and crops; Tāwhiri Mātia, god of weather, I suppose, climate, celestial things; Whero, of bad things; Ruo Moko was the, it's probably relevant here, of earthquakes and things like that. Tāne was successful in forcing that separation. It's a very commonly known story now. And that process of creation followed that included shaping of the natural world. What they had created wasn't suitable for people to live in. So there was that task still left to do, to create a place suitable for people, for mankind. And so that's just a bit of an overview there, really, to give you some of the divisions of the duties of that whakapapa, pokoharua te poa on the left there, first wife of Raki Nui, and then Papa Tuanuku over to the right. See, they had different families. Pokoharua, Te Pō, and Raki Nui had Aoraki. That's who, you know, we know otherwise as Mau Kok. And then his younger brothers were the next highest peaks, and that, we'll get to that. But it gives you an idea of how our people saw and created that family tree that explained creation and who did what to create the earth as we know it is now. And so Māori or life force, that's where it comes from, those creation traditions. You've heard of the Big Bang, but this is our equivalent of it, from darkness to light to the great spread of water,
celestial beings doing certain things to create a habitat suitable for people. So the Māori comes from the gods, transcends the ages, and it's a vital element of life, vitality, then and now. It represents a connectedness from the beginning of time. All objects, animate and inanimate, possess a Māori, be it water, trees, flora, fauna, stone. The Meniatua or demigods, they were the guardians, kaitiaki, of the domain. And certainly in traditional time, the people weren't kaitiaki, those atua were. Anyway, in this context, the function of tapu, i.e. restriction, and arises. So the mere mortals, people, deferred to the demigods if they were fishing or going to chop a tree down or do something to affect the domain of one of those atua. They were careful to acknowledge and say the right utterances before. And real, actually, if they caught a fish, the first one was always thrown back. Oh, sorry, next one. And so, having addressed those elements, we come to our myths, values and beliefs, coming down to sort of people level almost now, having addressed those central cultural kaitau elements. So how we populate the landscape with our stories. A storyline that involves waka, because you know we're an island way out in the middle of nowhere, so to speak. And so it's the manner in which our ancestors arrived in this land on their momentous oceanic journey from their distant homelands. They came from the islands of Te Moana Nui Akiwa, Hawaiki Nui, Hawaiki Roa, Te Waiki Pamamau. We may not necessarily know exactly where they were, but they were distant lands, their homelands, back in the Hawaiki, so to speak. The Great Ocean, basically, somewhere out there in the Pacific. And so, just going back to Aoraki, there it is. There's the mountain, and Aoraki is that oldest brother of that first marriage. They came down from their heaven. In our traditions, they live in the celestial heavens, and they came down to visit Papatua Nuku, the second wife, and their children, their half brothers and sisters. After voyaging around the ocean, it was time to return to the celestial home, but they made a mistake in their karakia, and the waka founded, the waka of Aoraki founded, tipped on, listed on its side. The brothers clambered to the high side and were turned to stone. Hence, Aoraki is there, the oldest brother, the highest point in Te Waipounamu, Te Waka Aoraki, whatever. There's quite a few names for the South Island. That's where they are, and it became, well, here you are, one of the names, Te Waka o Aoraki. So their nephew, in some accounts anyway, Tutaraki Whanau, was given the job of determining where they were, these boys who got stuck down here, and he discovered their waka had become an island in the vast ocean. And he set about with his aide, Te Hamo, shaping the waka into a place fit for human habitation, forming peninsulas, estuaries, places suitable for settlement and what have you. And his very last task was actually peotahi. And he thought it was so beautiful that he should do something that stopped people lingering. And so he released what we call namu namu, and otherwise they're sandflies. And that's why the sandflies are there. So these are the stories that populate the landscape. The waka Aoraki is another waka. It's not the one we've just been talking about. It was Te Waka Aoraki, sometimes known as Ka Huruhuru Manu as well, Te Huruhuru Manu as well. But it was responsible for transporting ogres like the Pauakai, which was their giant man-eating child-eating anyway, bird that was here formerly, the Kararua, a deceitful lizard, lured unwitting spouses to their death, and a well-known Tāne Whau, the Kopuwai, which you know, which is the obelisk today, on top of an old man range, and he had a pack of two-headed dogs that would prey on people who strayed from their party. Probably a story that was well told often by parties travelling through the interior to keep the kids close at hand so they didn't get lost or stray. So they're all of those ogres or tāne whau associated with inland Otago. The Arai Turu Waka is another well-known waka. Once again, it's really a waka atua, people, not living people really, they're still in their demigod phase of our stories here. And in our tradition, it became waterlogged as it came down the east coast of the South Island, hit some heavy seas off the Waitaki River mouth and lost some of its cargo at Moeraki. You'll know the big boulders there, the Moeraki boulders and food baskets and kumara seed that were washed ashore, you see in the sand and the gravel on the beach. But there were many passengers on that waka, at least 80 in some accounts. And most of them made it ashore after it foundered at Shag Point, Matakaia. And they were, one of the rules was strange land. You don't know who's here. Travel at night, be back by daylight. And of course, many of them didn't make it back by daylight and they were turned to stone. And so over time, they all were turned to stone. And in some accounts, many of the mountains are named after those passengers. And that's how they're remembered, including in some accounts, Aoraki was a passenger in some accounts. But much of that east coast of Otago and inland Otago, the mountains and some places are named after the passengers who were on the Arai Turu. Rākai Hautu and the Waitaha. This is actually people arriving now on the land. The Uruo, who was an early waka, it landed on the Nelson Boulder Banks. And there was a father and son there. Rākai Hautu chose to come down through the centre of the island with some people, while he sent his son Rokohaui around the east coast to explore the east coast of the South Island and see what it was like and where good food sources were. But Rākai Hautu, he journeyed through the centre of the island, and to remember the story, they credited him with digging the big lakes all the way down and naming them. And he also made this comment as well, he puna waimari, meaning pools of bounty, he puna hawaitu, which is pools of freezing cold water, referring to the many cold alpine lakes, which they wouldn't have known, because we think Rākai Hautu, these people came straight from the islands. They may have stopped in the North Island, there's very little evidence of that. And he puna karikari, pools dug by the hand of man. So that foretold the Waitaha people, the very first people to land on this land in the South Island, to Waipana, counted waterways full of food for the people, lakes that would be freezing beyond all belief, and the glacial pools and the lakes excavated by man. So Rākai Hautu, to do that digging, he carried an enormous spade to Whakaroria, and he plunged it into the soil and a lake would appear. So this is how they remember ancestors, how they remember their journeys, who was on, where they travelled. And so this is because they didn't have a written language, they had to have these fantastic stories to remember their kōrero, or where they came from, their whakapapa, all of these elements that I'm talking about. So these lakes included Rutaroa, Rotoroa, and Rotoiti, Takapō. That's not a spelling mistake, that's the proper spelling. Takapō, Pukaki, Oho, that's the proper spelling. And in lakes in QLDC area, of course, Hāwea, Wānaka, Whakatipu Waimari, which is Wakatipu, and so on. So Kati Māmoe were the people who followed the Waitaha. They came from the east coast, the North Island, via Wellington, and intermarried with the Waitaha over time. Raki Tauneki was a mobile, very mobile Kati Māmoe chief. He lived at Goose Bay, you know, that's near Kaikoura, Opihi, Aitak, with Otago Heads. inland Otago, west coast. He ventured over there to do some stuff, mouth of the Matau, and he died down near Bluff at Waiomokomoko, and he's buried on Bluff Hill. Tu Wiriroa was a contemporary of Taraki Taunaki, and he lived here for a couple of years, continuously for 2 years, down at Tahuna, down at the bay there. And it was his, at one time he did, but he was also at the mouth of the Kawara. But his daughter, Haki Tukura, a well-known story here around Queenstown, she was that celebrated swimmer who swam the lake here, across over there to the Cecil Peak side of the lake. Seems a pretty amazing feat. And so there's a lot of places named after her, after that feat, and some of her prominent landmarks around here named after Haki Tukura. At that time, a Kaitahu woman was living with Tuwiriroa, and she died. And Tuwiriroa thought, oh, well, he might get the blame for that, so he thought he should relocate. And he did, down to the mouth of the Tairi on the Otago coast, and he built a pa there, Motu Para. I'm not sure if I talk about Haki Tukura, but she died there. We go on to Kaitahu. To Weka, he was the son of Raki Tamau of Taumutu, just south of Lake Ellesmere. See, this story covers the whole island. These people are very mobile, and there's so much interlinking elements of it. But they sent, he went up to the Waitaha village that was at Karehu at Wanaka to obtain a Waitaha wife for his father. One of the key things the Māmoi and Kaitahu would do, the chief always liked if they could marry a Waitaha woman, because it gave their offspring whakapapa to the earliest people, and mana to the land. That's how they obtain mana. One of the components of obtaining mana, one of. Things went awry on that trip anyway, and ended up in the routing of the Waitaha. And their chief Potiki Tautahi, he died in that incident. And just to show that while Te Weka went up there to get a wife for his father from the Waitaha, the chief of the Waitaha was his uncle. So there's intermarriage had been going on for some time. There's quite a lot of interconnection. There wasn't a distinct difference between them, close connections. Waitaha, anyway, abandoned the Wanaka area, but they did remain at the Oho area in association with the Kati Māmoi. So a leading Kai Tuahuriri chief from Kaiapoi, which is just north of Christchurch, Kawareri and Pari Kiori, brought a war party down to gain some utu for the loss of the chief at Wanaka. But they were heading down. They wanted to catch up with a Kati Māmoi chief, the senior chief of Kati Māmoi, who was in Southland. But they came through up the Waitaki, through the Lindis, came through here. And they bumped into Tute Mākohu down at Waitaramea, which is Five Rivers, down there in Southland. And there was a bit of a to-do down there, and Kawereri was killed. And Tute Mākohu, he escaped that affray. But so, you know, there's efforts in making peace to settle all these differences. Raki here, a senior Kati Māmoi chief, sort of truce with Kaitahu to settle those long and intermittent difficulties. So he went and visited Te Hautapa Nui or Tu, who was the paramount chief at Kaiapoi. Marriages were arranged, and Raki here married Hini Hākari, a sister of Te Hau, while Kohuwai, the granddaughter of Raki here, married Honeko, the son of Te Hau. This is possibly about 1700s. Raki here returned to Pokekura, tired or head, and Te Hau accompanied him, and Raki here unfortunately was mortally wounded in a domestic incident. And so further skirmishes occurred, the peace hadn't quite been sealed, in South Otago, where a truce was gained, and a marker was placed there near Clinton called Popotunor to mark that's Māmoe, that's Kaitahu, and there was peace between them by and large. There was still a few other issues to sort out, and some Otago chiefs finished that off down there in South Otago, pretty well, probably the last fight. So, the trails into the interior include via the Waitaki Valley, which I referred to. They could come through Danzies or Lindis Pass, up the Waihemel or Shag River, the Pig Route, or up the Waiti catchment into the Taieri, or up the Taieri itself catchment, up the Matau, coming up to Clutha, or even up the Mataura River catchments. There's many, these are main trails, but there are many other variations. And returning to the coast could be by Mokahi, which was a reed raft. They could travel down this main river easily to the coast. So the natural bridge at Kawarau is an important trail link near the Roaring Meg, and link north-south, you know, Nevis going south or going north into Wanaka, up over into the Cadrona and out into Wanaka. And many, many subsidiary trails linked to temporary campsites which from which hunting expeditions crisscrossed the interior of Otago. Waka were used on the lakes, as well as Mokahi, that's the rope or reed rafts. Mokahi were also used to cross rivers or travel downstream on rivers as far as the coast, carrying people and resources. Mokahi had a better load carrying capacity and demonstrated better stability and safety in the turbulent waters of the South Island, and were the preferred option going down rivers compared to the Waka Tiwai, which might have been used in the North Island. The ready availability of Raupo in the interior of Otago ensured the Mokahi were utilised on the Matau, Clutha, making the task of transporting people, mahi, kakai and stone resources to the coast quite possible. Ponamu, the Dart River, there's a Numuti site there, plus associated with an old campsite. Key staging point in the Ponamu expeditions. Ponamu was highly prized for its ability to hold an edge, suitable for weapons, tools and ornaments, and trade. Because of its durability, Ponamu tauka was passed from generation to generation as treasured whānau heirlooms and carry much mana. The Dart River, or otherwise known as Te Awa Whakatipu, settlement site acted as a temporary campsite for expeditions to gather, initially shape and then convey raw Ponamu by waka and Mokahi down to the coast, and probably go north or south. A lot of that stone ended up around the Otago Harbour area, was manufactured there and traded further north for kumara, which you couldn't grow south of Christchurch, and things like that, and for other important exchanges as well. The Waitaki chief Huru Huru drew a sketch of the interior for Edward Shortland that showed several lakes, one named Waka Tipua, that was celebrated for the Ponamu found on its shores and in the mountain torrents. I think we had that map up earlier on. He drew that in 1844, before any Europeans ever came inland here. The term Mahika Kai refers to places where food and other resources were gathered or produced. Mobile small groups used trails, temporary or seasonal campsites, and sustain themselves in hunter-styled gathering style. During this period, the Waitaha applied their names and mythology to the landscape, which I've been referring to. The resources sought included eel, kanakana, kiori, birds, trees, fern, tikauka, patches, flax, naropo, tarame, ponamu, schist, porcelainite, to name many common ones. When the moa were abundant, extended inland summer visits took place. Whānau traversed to all parts of the district to find stones, plants and other resources which were adapted for use. The moa probably allowed them to really fossick around heavily and discover whatever was here, because they had a huge food source for some time to keep them, sustain them. As autumn drew on, inland hunting groups invariably would return to coastal villages, carrying their kits of preserved food, dried moa, stone materials, and materials such as mountain daisy, leaves, and lace bark to the coast. Just a snapshot. This is in 1836, Ngāti Tama chief Tupu Oho had the idea that he would attack Ngaitahu from the tail, which is Murihiku. And so he came down from Nelson with about 50 warriors. He captured a few people here in Otago as he went through this part of Otago. He came through the Haast Pass, and at Makarore, he came upon a hunting group of about 9 people, and he took them prisoner and killed 2 children. He sent 2 scouts to Manapaya, which is the neck, with a prisoner to guide the way. The head man there, Taraki, overpowered the scouts, and he escaped down with his people to the mouth of Lake Hawea, where there was another group. He alerted them to the danger, and they travelled down, went through the Lindis Pass and went down the Waitaki River to the coast. And then Tupu Oho came across a group at an island near Wanaka Township, so to speak, where the head man, Te Mohene, and 4 people were captured. And from there, Tupu Oho went up the Katrona, across the natural bridge, and through Papapuni or Nevis, and dropped down into the Garston area on his way to Tutaro, where he met his end. But it's just a snapshot, just someone passing through the area, probably spent 2 weeks or so on that journey. So it just captures who was here, who was doing what and where they were. He didn't see all the villages that were here at that time. That was 1836, and it was the last fight in South Island, between tribes in South Island. So other inland connections, villages not mentioned in that account, include Nehi at the Mātukituki River, several other villages that were at Lake Hawea, hunting groups from the lower Waitaki, Moiraki and Waihole localities frequented these lakes on a seasonal basis. In 1844, I mentioned Chief Huruhuru drew a map of the area, but he indicated it took 9 days to walk inland from the coast to Wanaka or Hawea. Karatai, my ancestor of Otago, was born in Lake Hawea and indicated an association of the our hapu kaitapahi with the interior. Matahari was another who was associated with South and rural Puke Islands, but as well as the east coast of Otago, was known to be seasonally in the interior. Haimoana Rakiraki, he says he was Kati Maimoi from South Otago, was at Lake Hawea when Puoho came through. He lived normally down at Kaka Point area. And then Reko, he was actually a refugee from Haiapoi, but became quite prominent up here, lived at the vicinity of Tutaro, and he was the person who guided Nathaniel Chalmers, the first European to make it in to as far as Lake Wanaka. I've forgotten what year that was, in the 1850s I think it was. And then, look, H.K. Tairoa, 1880 report, is a part of, how are we going for time? H.K. Tairoa is part of the, our claim started by Te Rimoirehu actually in 1849, and to substantiate our claim, Tairoa went around and interviewed Kaumātua, around that time, and he produced a report on places and the resources that our people could get at those places, because they were losing access to those places and the right to go there was being made difficult, and they were crammed into their small reserves that were reserved from sale. And so he says, our food gathering sites have simply been taken away. Our food gathering sites have been taken and we have been deprived of food sources. We go to our food sites only to be harassed by the Pākehā. We did not agree to this in the land sales. We do not have any money. Our old die because there are no hospitals, and we say that our settlements and our food gathering sites should be returned to us. This is why these names are listed here. And this is why our kōrero about tūpuna is important to us, so that we have retained those associations and connections. That's, I just added that last bit. Peter Moirehu was still alive in 1879, but he was speaking at the Smithsonian Royal Commission that Tairoa was reporting to as well. And he said this, all that is left now are the big rivers where they run right up into the mountains, and all our mahika kai in regard to our eels, inaka, and other fishes are all dried up. Stone buildings and houses are standing on what were mahika kai. The rivers are closed to us and reserves are insufficient to support us. The young men may be able to work at shearing and harvesting, but for a large part of the year there is no work to do. They complain that although they have a closed season for eels, Europeans catch them all the year round. In olden times, the natives had control of these matters, but the advent of the Europeans and the settlement of the country changed the state of affairs and destroyed the protection that formerly existed. Consequently, their mahika kai, food producing places, are rendered more worthless every year. And that was in 1871. Much has changed since then. One more, I think. So the Ngaitaunga Claim Settlement Act 1998 includes taonga species, a list of birds, plants and fish with provisions. They are a taonga, part of our heritage. They also have statutory acknowledgements for Lake Hawea, Lake Waraka, Titi Tea, Ngāti Whare, Piki Rakatahi, Whakatipu Wai Māori and the Mātāau. And there are tōpuni, which are sort of a protective cloak, so to speak, that lay over Mount Asparag, Titi Tea, Piki Rakatahi, which is Mount Earnslaw, and Te Koro Ka, which is where the Pounamu source, key Pounamu source in this catchment is. Might be another one. And that's just from our tribal mapping project, gives some of the place names in this immediate vicinity of Queenstown. And that's the last slide, I think, sir.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ellison. Really appreciate that introduction. We'll hear you back on the 21st. I'm sure that the other commissioners like me have a lot of questions to ask you on the 21st. But as I say, I appreciate that opening address. The next step is there are two procedural applications that I want to address with Ms. Scott initially.
Kia ora. Thank you.
Thank you very much. However, there are, Mr. Enright, if you wish to be heard, I should have said in the opening that the assembled multitude at this front desk is in fact the only time we will all be present together. I think everybody is aware that different commissioners are sitting on different parts of the hearing. And so as this week wears on and we complete various sectors, so after we complete Stream 16 in relation to Wahi Tupuna and related matters, Commissioner Cheatham will exit stage right, and then we'll move to another stage 17, and at the completion of that, Commissioners Smith and Munro will exit, leaving the hard core, so to speak, to hold the fort. Now, we have two procedural issues. Mr. Enright, you made an application seeking effectively leave to present a written reply from two of your witnesses, and I told you that I would prefer that you didn't do that and you would let us ask questions, and as I said to Mr. Ellison, you can be assured that we have a lot of questions for your witnesses, and then consider at the end of that whether there are any loose ends that you feel the need. And I suppose the question is, are you happy with that, or would you like to press the point?
Thank you. Morena koutou, for those of you who have not met me, Rob Enright, Council, obviously for Kaitahu. And I think we simply wanted to signal that in the usual course, we would have had an opportunity to provide written rebuttal, and because of simply timetabling and the clash with COVID-19, that didn't happen. So I did just want to signal that that might be an issue, but it may not be. I'm content with your indication that we'll have a reasonably full opportunity to have some Q&A on our day of presentation, 21 July, and if there were any concerns, then you've given me leave to raise them then, that we could seek leave to address targeted issues if necessary. So we're happy with that approach. In addition, we agree it's appropriate that we should file an amended version of relief by 17 July, I think was the date.
I'm grateful for that, because I suppose the earlier you can do that, the greater our opportunity to test that with submitters.
Yes.
And rather than submitters asking to have the right of reply on Mr. Bathgate's amended position and going in an endless loop. But I appreciate that may not be possible, but if you could treat the 17th as a deadline, but before earlier if possible, that would be appreciated.
Certainly, and of course we're going to have a presence to hear the submitters' presentations, and particularly the expert witnesses in terms of their interactions with commissioners. We're very close, I think, to Council's position on much, not everything, but much of the amended relief. So there has certainly been a narrowing of issues in terms of the evidence filed by even by submitters on the whole. So
I'm grateful for that, Mr. Enright.
Thank you.
Ms. Scott, the next second procedural issue is the application we've received by Arthurs Point Partnership to file a late further submission. I've received a written memorandum from Mr. Leakey on behalf of the submitter, Arthurs Point Trustee Limited, and I said I either wanted a response in writing or in person, anticipating you might have more pressing things to do in the run-up to the hearing than file yet another memorandum. So what's the Council's position?
Thank you. Good morning, and good morning, everyone. So I have read Mr. Leakey's memorandum that he's filed for the Arthurs Point Land Trust. It is very comprehensive, and it covers all the matters that you will need to consider in the decision. The Council abides your decision on the waiver, and I can advise, I'm not acting on behalf, but I have received an email from Ms. Baker Galloway this morning advising that she will also abide the Chair's decision.
It won't surprise you that I've been thinking about this following, given the time opportunity due to the late arrival of my colleague, Commissioner Dawson. There's a silver lining in every cloud, because it gave me time to think about this memorandum. Appreciate your position. My position is that we're not going to accept late submission. If you could advise Ms. Baker Galloway that I'll release a memorandum, but the answer is going to be no.
Certainly.
And is there anybody else here who's got any procedural issues that they want to raise at this time before I ask Ms. Scott to open the Council's case? Deafening silence results. then Ms. Scott, you have the floor.
Thank you. Well, I would like to be appearing with Ms. Morto, but she was also on the yesterday's flight, and she wasn't lucky enough to get on the jet this morning, so she should be here midday. she will be here later on and with me for the week. So just a little bit of housekeeping. We have filed legal submissions. They are in two parts in terms of the body of the legal submissions and some appendices. We have filed, I think, all of the council's highlight summaries for the week, so you have them with you. We have just handed up hard copies for today, but when Ms. Morto gets here, we'll get the rest of the copies to you. So my intention with these legal submissions is to present them in three parts, and this morning I'll only focus on some general matters and those relevant to Hearing Stream 16 and Waiatupuna, and I will leave the rest for during the week as we progress. So some of this is common material for those who have been involved in various hearing streams on the district plan review. I don't intend to repeat those this morning or read through these. I just would like to focus on some of the key points. If I don't cover what you're interested in, please just ask me questions and I'll do my best to assist. But I do just, I guess at the start, highlight, as we have in the past, that we haven't addressed every issue in these legal submissions. We haven't addressed every submission or site. We've been critiqued on that in the past, as if that meant the council didn't have an issue with a particular submission. That's not the case. I just simply can't cover everything. Otherwise, it would probably be only me you hear from this week. So that's just a qualifier in terms of what I have covered in these written submissions. So this morning, it is still this morning, I will just cover some wider plan matters. I will give you an update on the Otago Regional Policy Statement and also where we have got to on some Stage 1 and Stage 2 plan review matters. So that's how we are advancing through the Environment Court appeals and some matters that have been resolved. And then just briefly some matters on Hearing Stream 16. So if I can take you to Section 3 on page 5 of my legal submissions. I don't intend to get into the planning matters today. I'm going to leave that to the planners, but I will touch.
Very wise.
I will. It's the wisest thing I've done today, I think. But Mr. Barr has filed what we call strategic evidence, and the purpose, there's a few purposes of that evidence, but what I wanted him to do was give an update to the panel on where we are at. He has been heavily involved in mediation of appeals on the strategic chapters and also on topic 2, the Rural Landscape Environment Court work. So he will take you through that. Attached to his strategic evidence is a very colourful version of chapters 3 and 6, and that includes the provisions that have been decided on by the Environment Court in what I'll call topic 2, it's decision 2.2, but it's the main decision from the Environment Court on the rural landscapes, and it is relevant to your recommendations throughout the course of this hearing. It is an interim decision, hence why none of those changes are in the decisions version of the PDP, which is on the website. We're still working, we still need to get some more decisions out of the Environment Court before we can translate them into the PDP. There has been some clarification through that decision and also what I call the Topic 1 decision, which is the first decision, and it was on business and it was called Resilient Economy was the name of the hearing. But in those decisions, the court has confirmed extra text to go into the strategic chapters of the PDP, which better clarifies or is clearer in terms of the relationship of the strategic directions chapter with chapters 4, urban development, chapter 5, which is tangata whenua, and chapter 6, which is rural landscapes, and with the rest of the district plan. So that is already included in an interim decision from the court. We also have directions from the court to propose wording which would go into chapters 1, which is the introduction chapter, and chapter 4, urban development, 5, tangata whenua, and 6, rural landscapes. And we have provided that text to the court, but it's not subject to a decision yet.
Ms. Scott, can we take the versions that you've given us as not 10 tenths, but all but?
I'd like to. So yes, so the appendix to Mr. Barr's strategic evidence, yes. There were High Court appeals to some of the wording in there. They have been discontinued, so they are beyond appeal. There are certain matters in there, and we've highlighted them, where further work has to be done. There's more drafting around some strategic policies and that type of thing. But the substance of the provisions which are attached to Mr. Barr's strategic evidence are now beyond appeal. And in terms of the further work that we're currently doing, the decision from Judge Hassan is pretty clear about where we're heading. So we're starting, we've started that, we've got timetable directions now, and it's just a matter of working through it.
And in relation to the provisions of Chapter 4 that Mr. Place has provided in his rebuttal, is that in the same category?
No, it's not. So there have not been any hearings or decisions on Chapter 4. We took that chapter to mediation and have agreed to settle all appeals on Chapter 4. There is a draft consent order, well, there's actually two draft consent orders which are with the court at the moment, but they haven't been issued. So all parties to the appeals have signed up to them, which is important, but until they're issued by the court, they're not final.
So again, unlikely to change, but can't be certain.
That's correct. I'd like to think they won't change, but that's out of my hands.
I understand.
There's one other consent order that I'll mention, which is relevant to the strategic chapters, and that is the draft consent order on regionally significant infrastructure. Those provisions have been mediated. Their draft consent order is with the court, and I hope that the court will issue them soon. I can't see anything else holding that up at the moment. But in terms of the relevance of that, it was actually two consent orders. I don't think it's particularly relevant to anything. Well, actually, there is one matter, and that is the final wording of the Aurora consent advice note. Because that has come through that mediation. There's been a little bit of confusion there.
Yeah.
And perhaps Ms. Dorr will clarify that. But from the council's perspective, we're looking for consistency there. And I think there's just a bit of confusion about whether it's the subdivision advice note or the zone advice note that comes into the chapters. At the end of the day, we're happy to put it in. And that's been covered in the evidence. So,
You were talking before about the chapters 3 and 6 attached to Mr. Barr's evidence, and
yes,
how it's sort of you're hoping that it's 90% there. Does that include the interim decision on topic 1?
Yes.
So it's sort of 90% there from both the interim decisions, the topic 1 and topic 2 decisions?
Yes, so the text, which is shaded blue,
yeah,
is topic 1.
Mm.
That's certainly beyond appeal. There are actually, and Mr. Barr's mentioned this, since that there are three more strategic objectives which have been confirmed by the Environment Court which aren't in this version. Mr. Barr mentions this in his highlights summary. But that's correct. The only thing we're waiting for in topic one is the court's confirmation of the clarification text that we have proposed to insert into chapters 1, 4, 5 and 6,
yes.
Clarifying the relationship between those chapters. And in terms of what we've proposed...
And you've proposed the wording for that, but it just hasn't come
That's right,
to you.
In a decision. Yeah. And, okay. and what we proposed was entirely consistent with submissions that were made by the by myself during the course of that hearing and other parties.
Yeah. Okay, all right, thank you for that.
So if that wasn't confusing enough, I'll now turn to the regional policy statement. So last week we received a consent order from Judge Jackson and it covered chapter 3 of the proposed regional policy statement and a small part of chapter 5. So Mr. Barr's strategic evidence foreshadowed that there was still work being done in this area. So what this means is that, well, first of all, the judge has given parties until the end of this week to advise whether they've got any issues with the consent order. So these submissions assume that nothing will be filed. So the all that's left in terms of unresolved appeals on the proposed RPS is a policy relating to ports, and I can tell you that's not relevant, which is excellent.
Yes, I was going to say, hopefully we don't need to worry about that.
And then some appeals by Oceana Gold on policy 5.4.6 and related methods, which is to do with offsetting for Indigenous biodiversity. Again, my submission on that is I don't think it's relevant to any of the submissions before you. I think happy to be corrected, but I don't think it's relevant. So I have been in touch with Council for Otago Regional Council on those appeals, and they've advised that they understand that this means the 1998 RPS essentially is gone because there are no equivalent provisions on the port and the offsetting policy. So that's good. What is a little bit more confusing though is how we work out what is currently in the proposed RPS, because at this point in time the Regional Council hasn't made it operative, and it can't do that until after Friday when we find out if there are any issues. So just to try and help you, I've added links to two versions of the RPS. The first is on the screen. This is the parts of the RPS that were made operative by the Otago Regional Policy, the Otago Regional Council last year. So that's all good, that version. And the second version, and this is where it gets confusing, this is the version that the Regional Council made available at the same time. And this version sets out parts of the proposed regional policy statement that were not appealed, and it also sets out a bunch of agreed draft consent orders and things like that. The only parts of this which are now relevant for you are, and we need to read this beside the consent order, is the consent order issued last week only sets out changes that have been made. So there are parts of chapter 3 in the consent order and there are parts in there. So if it's not in the consent order, you refer to that version to find the rest of chapter 3. And it's the same for chapter 5. So that's the extent of the relevance of that, is chapter 3 and some parts of chapter 5.
Ms. Scott, did the team at ORC tell you that, assuming no one surfaces by Friday, that they intend to put the Coleman have the new consent order to the council and produce an updated partially operative RPS?
They could.
And when can we hope to see it?
They couldn't advise me on timing. I have pushed them to do it in the past, so perhaps we could again. But there might be a little bit of reluctance, possibly, until the residual matters are resolved, given the complexities that it came about by making this operative in part. So
yes, Judge Jackson had some things to say about that. I read that.
He did.
Well, that was very helpful.
Yeah, so, I mean, hopefully, if there are any updates during the course of the hearing and, of course, during our reply and before any recommendations are made, I'll let you know. But at the moment, that's the sort of best way to find out what is now in the proposed RPS. And assuming no issues on Friday, I would submit significant weight can be given to those changes.
Not operative, but all but.
That's correct.
And what's attached to your submissions is just the consent order part.
That's the latest consent thing. Order. That's correct.
Yes, so my recollection is that the partially operative RPS is 150 pages.
It is. Yeah. So I think we can take that down. Just turning quickly back to the district plan, I just want to clarify a couple more matters. The first is the consolidated version of the decisions version, which is the PDFs on the council's website. So that is updated as consent orders are issued. The court has issued quite a number of consent orders in the last few weeks. The council can only update that so quickly. So the version that you have is not relevant as of today. So there are some relevant consent orders which haven't been incorporated into the consolidated version of the PDP. And they are, the most relevant one is the natural hazards consent order, and that is attached to
Mr. Place,
thank you, one of his
second rebuttal.
In terms of what has been issued, that's the key one. If any others come up, we'll let you know.
And of course it doesn't include chapters 3 and 6 because they're not actually the subject of consent orders yet.
And the decisions are interim. Yes. There are some other more significant, I'd submit, draft consent orders that have been signed up to by all parties and are sitting with the court. I've mentioned Chapter 4, Urban Development. Another one is the rural zone. So almost all appeal points on the rural zone are subject to a signed draft consent order, which is with the court at the moment. I am advised that a draft consent order on earthworks will be lodged in the next couple of weeks, and that will be relevant to your considerations on Waheatapuna. And I understand a consent order on noise has also been filed, and I'm unsure of the relevance of that one, but just if it comes up, we can get you a copy.
I think it might be relevant to Arthur's point, the late submission that I let in that we're going to hear on the 12th of August.
Possibly. It might also be relevant to the Earnslaw area and the variation to the Queenstown town centre area, so the submission by Queenstown Wharf, possibly.
Yes, that as well.
Okay, so I've sufficiently confused everyone, so I'll carry on. Are there any questions on those matters?
There's another consent order on the Gibson Valley Resort Zone?
Yes, that has been issued, and so the via a consent order, the court has confirmed a new Gibston resort zone.
Just have a site that's right beside that.
Yes.
That will be quite useful to have that.
The version, the chapter. Mm-hmm. Okay.
I think more generally, I might, while everybody's actually on the premises, Scott, I think we'll compare notes and give you a list of documents we think would be useful for us to have, rather than getting drip feeding them and us getting, well, losing important documents among the flood of paper that's flying around generally, if we get them in one hit, because these consent orders, particularly the ones that have been made, but also the ones that are yet to be made, are going to be important for our to put the submitters' evidence we hear in context, and there'll be issues we need to put to the submitters arising out of those consent orders. So, as I say, I'll ask the commissioners to contribute to a complete list, and we'll hand it over probably tomorrow.
Certainly happy to do that. And apologies for not having a complete list, but I guess the ground is sort of moving before us, so happy to do that, and we can provide updates later on in the hearing.
I think the way we should do it is give you a list of as is, where is.
Mm-hmm.
If you could give, as I say, give it to us as is, where is, as soon as before the conclusion of the council case, then only give us things that, in your view, are reasonably important during the hearing, but give us an update, a complete update with your reply.
Certainly. I think it would be helpful if there was two lists, one of issued consent orders, and the second would be draft consent orders with the court.
Indeed. Separated out. We don't want to mix them up.
Thank you. Okay, so section four of my submissions, I set out there a summary of the approach that needs to be taken to scope. With your leave, Mr. Chair, I won't take you through that.
I am happy for you to take us read, but I do have a question about the wisdom of the course that you are suggesting. I'm conscious that in previous stages, submissions have been struck out. The submitter has appealed and successfully, and that has then produced some complications because it has to come back to the panel for consideration on the merits. So while I note that a number of your witnesses have recommended that particular submissions be struck out, as I say, I query the wisdom of accepting that advice rather than just recommending that the submission be refused, and if that way, if the submitter wants to challenge it, they can appeal, and it'll all end up before the Environment Court along with the other 500 appeals.
Yes, well, I'm happy to talk to that. The reason behind that approach is if the appeal is struck out, then there is no right of appeal. If the panel simply declines the submission, that is essentially accepting that there was scope to make the submission in the first instance, and then we have to deal with the matter. Then there's the right to lodge an appeal, and we still end up having the same argument as to whether there was scope. So council's preference is that the decision is made now, that there's no scope for the submission. I appreciate that there's a right to object to that, but in my experience it's easier to do that now rather than before the Environment Court.
I understand. I just want to emphasise this panel's not hugely enthusiastic about coming back the middle of next year to rehear submissions that have been struck out, but the strikeout was successfully objected to?
Yeah, well, I think it will perhaps help that the council has taken one obvious and different approach to scope in this hearing, and that is to do with rezoning submissions sought on land that hasn't been notified in stage 3 or 3B. Where that submitter has sought a stage 3 or 3B zone. So the council has considered those submissions as on stage 3. And I think that probably deals with quite a significant number of the submissions. So the appeal points which the council has taken an objection to in terms of scope, I think that they're not of the size and significance of what we were dealing with in earlier stages.
Yes, well, the ones that were successfully objected to, one related to a site-specific issue at on the shot over, on the Middleton property, and the other one I recall related to informal airports.
Yes,
which you wouldn't have thought was a huge issue in the scheme of things.
Yeah. No, that's fair. I'm not saying they're any less significant in terms of those submission points, but there has to be a line drawn as to whether submissions are on stage 3 or not.
I don't disagree. I'm just saying what's the best way to draw the line, whether it's actually by way of strikeout or by a recommendation that the submission not be granted because it's out of scope. But your answer is council would prefer to have the argument if it's going to on an objection rather than in the Environment Court.
Yes, that's correct.
Understand.
So turning to section 5, so the first I guess complete hearing stream, Wahitapuna. I just note at the outset that, and this has been referred to already this morning, that there wasn't an opportunity for rebuttal evidence. Ms Picard, the Council's Section 42 reporting officer, I have said to her she can breach the two-page limit by a couple to address some of the matters that were raised in submitter's evidence, but it's also she has provided a revised chapter, and so I have asked her to set out the changes that she is recommending. I think that's important that is before the panel at the start. So
can I say it? Don't have an issue with that for the same reason I've said to Mr. Enright. It is helpful that if your witness has changed her recommendation, that we don't waste time going over the reasons for the previous recommendation that's now changed when the answer was I've moved past that.
Certainly. So they are attached to these submissions, the revised chapter, and they are also attached to Ms. Pickard's highlight summary. So Mr. Allison this morning has very thoughtfully and carefully taken you through the relationship of Mana Whenua and their culture and traditions with this district, and quite clearly set out, and the evidence does this in more detail for Kārunaka, the matters of cultural and spiritual value to Kaitahu. So in this, it's just address this briefly in these written legal submissions, but what the part two of the RMA does through each of sections 6, 7 and 8, they have some relevance, is require the council to recognise and provide for the relationship of Māori and their culture and traditions with their wāhi tapu. So the mapping of wāhi tapu recognises the relationship, but the question for
can I correct you?
Wāhi tapuna, sorry.
I think we're talking about wāhi tapuna.
Wāhi tapuna, apologies. The question for the chapter is how to provide for that relationship. what Section 6E requires is that there is consideration of the effects of proposed activities on the relationship of Māori with their wahi tapuna. Section 7A requires decision makers to have particular regard to Māori views regarding ways in which the land is used. Section 8 is also important, and I note there that it requires the district plan to enable active participation in the consultation with Māori, and that is one of the reasons that the chapter has the provisions it does, including certain notification requirements. The Otago Regional Policy Statement is relevant, and it does provide direction as to how councils in the region must recognise and provide for wahi tapuna within their district plans. I have footnoted their policy 222 and method 4. There has been some challenges in evidence to the boundaries of the overlays on the plan maps, and one of the reasons for that challenge is that the boundaries do not follow allotments or zone boundaries. I'm sure that will be addressed by Kaitahu, but that evidence in my submission ignores the purpose behind the overlays by aligning them arbitrarily with an allotment or a line on the map, ignores the purpose of them. And I'd make the same submission about, for example, an outstanding natural landscape or an outstanding natural feature. They do not necessarily have to follow a lot boundary or a property boundary.
Just picking up on that, Ms. Scott, I understand the point you're making. And as you say, you'd say exactly the same thing about an O&L. But there are costs that flow from not aligning with cadastral boundaries. And so frequently, while a purist landscape position would draw an O&L wherever the, for instance, or and more particularly even an ONF, which is even more defined beginning and end, would follow a contour. Frequently, those lines are tweaked to go round properties as an issue in terms of the balance of cost and benefit. And one of the things that the submitters criticised council for is the absence of a quantification of costs. Like, I understand that the council's reliant on Karunaka for telling it where the wahi tapuna are, but the council, of course, has its obligations under Section 32 before notifying a plan change to assess the to quantify, if possible, the costs and benefits of the provisions that it is notifying. So what's your response to all of those submitters who say, where is the council's quantification of costs?
Well, in terms of where, the Section 32 report, I accept, doesn't include a quantitative analysis of costs and benefits. It is more general. We do not have, I guess, evidence from an economist doing a full cost and benefit analysis on that. Part of the problem with doing that, and I would suggest leads to the impracticality, is that the overlays and the values have been informed by Mana Whenua. they hold the knowledge of the values. And therefore, in terms of providing a quantitative analysis, it's almost impractical to do that. But I accept that there's no full analysis in the Section 32 report. There's also been in the updated recommendations from Ms. Pickard some changes, and they I don't know if relax is quite the right word, but reduce the regulatory impact and the trigger on rules. The most obvious one is to do with the urban, the overlays in the urban areas. So following the evidence that was filed from Kaiwaikawe, Ms. Pickard has adopted their recommendation to essentially not trigger the consent requirements in those urban overlays.
I suppose the response I have is that Ms. Pickard rightly says this will reduce the cost, but less cost, but it still leaves the submitter saying less than what?
Mm.
Because if you start with a very large number, to carve out a proportion will make a difference, but the end result's still a large number. So is your response that the submitters have a valid point to a degree, but that from the council's point of view it's not practical to quantify?
Well, the difficulty is how you you quantify the effects on mana whenua, and that is certainly impractical. So you may be able to put a number on the consenting costs, for example, but to then balance that against the benefits to mana whenua of having these provisions, that is impractical to do.
Do you think that Section 32 would require you to quantify half the equation, or is your position that it's, if you can't quantify the whole equation, you better not quantify anything?
I don't think it suggests either, but there is a real risk. I mean, that people see a number and they place a lot of weight on it, and it is, and I think a cautious approach needs to be taken to that if you can only put a number on one side of the equation.
Is that in the old argument, we'll use the analogy with O&Ls, that you can quantify the effect, the constraint on development, but you can't quantify the intangible benefit of an outstanding landscape?
Absolutely, that's correct. It's very difficult to put a number on the value of our outstanding natural landscape to, for example, the tourists which are coming to this district.
Okay, thank you very much.
So just at paragraph 5.6, this is just to confirm really that the council did formally withdraw some very small parts of, I think, five overlays. So that was after filing of the Section 42A reports. The reason around this is to do with the staged approach to the plan, and nothing more than that. I have attached copies to it to my legal submissions. And then finally...
Before you go on, I had a question. You have, the council hasn't withdrawn the Waihi Tupuna overlays over the hydro generation zone. What's the rationale for that, for not doing that, given your explanation about why you withdrew the other ones?
I'll have to check. I'm not sure about that.
And I suppose going back, you said that the withdrawal was because of the staging. The suggestion that I've read from Cadrona Village was, I think it was there, that it was notification was a mistake. Do you accept that, or is it just that council, on reflection, prefers to leave that for another day?
Both. look, it goes to the structure of the district plan. So just to briefly cover this, the strategic chapters sit across the district. And as certain parts of the district go through this review process, they get a zone chapter, and then they get the district-wide proposed district. I'm going to call it the PDP. You get a zone chapter, for example, all of the rural zone, and any activities in that part of the district will also be subject to the proposed district plan district-wide chapters. So, for example, transport, noise, and so on. For those zones that haven't yet been through the review process, for example, Remarkables Park, the strategic chapters sit over the top, but those zone chapters are still subject to the old ODP district-wide chapters, for example, transport and noise. So if you start having some district-wide chapters from the new PDP and some district-wide chapters from the ODP applying, it is very, very complex from a consenting perspective. So essentially, they shouldn't have been notified.
I don't disagree. I've tried to figure this out before.
Yeah, they shouldn't have been notified, and that is why they've been withdrawn. And they will be... So what's been happening, and that is why, for example, you see when the council notified the settlement zone in Stage 3, there were also variations to, for example, the subdivision chapter, where there was a settlement zone-specific rule went into the subdivision chapter. There may be a settlement zone-specific rule went into earthworks, and so on. So that's as the land sort of comes through to the PDP zone and district-wide chapters.
So go back to where I started. You might care to think about the hydro zone.
Yes, I'll have a look at that. I don't know the answer to that. Sorry. If it has been missed, I would submit that the panel has jurisdiction to withdraw it from that zone through the submissions before it, which might be an easy solution.
Well, as I say, if you could think about that, if there's a good reason why it's not in the same category, then that's fine if you tell us about it.
Certainly. I'll come back to you on that. So just one final note. I've at paragraph 5.7, I have noted there that there's been a request through evidence for three additional overlays over, and they are located in urban areas. In discussions this morning, we have clarified that Kaitahu is not seeking to trigger consent through these three additional overlays. And Mr. Enright will address you on this, but I do, in due course, but I do understand the intention is just for those overlays to be shown on the plan maps in the same way as the other urban overlays. So they wouldn't, they'd essentially be a non-regulatory method in the district plan. I will leave Mr. Enright to address you on scope on that. I understand he is going to, but the fact that they wouldn't trigger any rules, I think, certainly softens the request that has come through.
I suppose I was going to ask you next why it was a problem given the schedule currently describes the urban areas, if the effect of mapping them is to clarify what the objectives and policies are applying to when the words already describe what they're applying to, in essence, what's the problem?
Well, when I filed these legal submissions, my understanding is there would be new overlays which would trigger a requirement for consent. And we don't have any submissions asking for new overlays. So that would have meant new consenting requirements.
Yeah, I can understand.
And that was the issue.
I can understand exactly that if there was, this was an area, a new area where rules would apply as a result of mapping, then that would be a problem.
Mm. Yes. Submitters on this chapter have gone to the plan maps to see where these overlays are located when preparing their submissions, and that was one of the concerns that we had there.
Okay. Understood. Commissioner, you know, please go.
Just before you move on, I just wanted to get your opinion on another aspect of the Section 32 report, and that is whether any other national policy statements or NMSs are relevant, because this here it's contended that they're not.
One of the briefs of evidence from a submitter, I think it's from a number of submitters, Mr. Devlin's evidence suggests that the urban development capacity NPS is relevant. I take from that evidence a suggestion that the consent requirements that come through the Wahe Tupuna chapter will impact on the council's development capacity assessment, which Ms. Hampson will address you on. My submission is that the NPS isn't, I don't think it's directly relevant to this proposal. Of course, all chapters in this plan include, well, not all of them, but most of them include consent requirements. And if every single rule had to be tested against the NPS, it would be a huge requirement for the council to have to undertake. My submission on that is it has very limited relevance. I don't think there are any others which are directly relevant. So it's 20 to 1. We might be able to get through Mr. Barr before lunch.
Well, before you go on, you're talking. Are you going to come back and address us on? Is your intention to hold over the balance of your submissions until the start of the respective streams?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Well, that's fine. Well, any remaining questions from Ms. Scott down to my left? Down to the right. Well, sounds like we should at least start with Mr. Barr.
Thank you. So you have a wee package of the summaries. Mr. Barr should be at the top of that. Where do you want to go?
Oh,
it's
underneath the water.
Someone
else
fill
it.
I'll just confirm the evidence that Mr. Barr's provided. So, I'm not sure if that's going to pick up. So, Mr. Barr, for the purposes of your appearance today, you have filed one statement of evidence dated 18th of March. It's titled Strategic Overview for All of Stage 3. Can you confirm that you have the qualifications and experience set out at the start of that evidence?
Yes.
Do you have any corrections to make?
No.
Okay, thank you. Not sure how formal we have to be, but...
Not that formal.
Okay, that sounds good. It might speed things up.
That's probably enough. Mr. Barr says it is what it is.
What I will do, I think, is just draw your attention to the relevant statements so that you know you've got them all. Okay, over to you, Mr. Barr.
Thank you. So just talking to my summary, at one, my strategic overview evidence includes a discussion on the relationship between the strategic chapters and reviewed and unreviewed areas and provisions of the district plan. And there's an illustration below, and I'll just pause there and take any questions on it or happily move on.
Everyone happy?
Yeah.
With the diagram?
Yeah.
All good?
Okay.
Yes, beautiful diagram.
Since filing my strategic evidence, the Environment Court has issued consent orders or decisions on the following matters that are relevant to Stage 3. The proposed Otago Regional Policy Statement, with the exceptions discussed by Ms. Scott. In terms of the PDP, at B, we have Topic 1 and the addition of three new objectives. Topic 2, as mentioned, the two High Court appeals have been discontinued, and the exception or the outstanding change from that is that the Council's agreed to identify the whole Upper Clutha RCL area as a priority area for scheduling and for future plan changes. In terms of Topic 3, all appeal points are resolved with two consent orders before the Environment Court. Topic 4, biodiversity is complete, and that includes Chapter 33, Chapter 34, which isn't mentioned there, but that's the wilding exotic trees chapter, and a handful of strategic objectives were also confirmed as part of that appeal. For Topic 5, heritage, a consent order has been issued. For Topic 7, a consent order has been issued as it relates at this stage to the urban zones. The key takeaway from that is that when you read either the consent order or the updated chapter that is on the Council's website, is that the activity status for subdivision in urban environments is a restricted discretionary activity, with the exception that activity that's supported by a structure plan that's in the proposed district plan and is consistent with that as a controlled activity. So that might have some bearing on the panel's consideration of some rezonings. Topic 8.
So just to clarify, so the consent order, it's remaining RDA unless it's supported by a structure plan.
That's right. So it's the same as the decisions version. There's changes to text along the way through matters of discretion and assessment matters. So Topic 8 were the Queenstown and Wanaka town centres, and consent orders have been issued for both, and also an Environment Court decision relating to pedestrian links. Came out a couple of weeks ago. Topic 10, temporary activities, the consent order has been issued for that. Topic 11 is the informal airports, and that has relevance to the late submission from Arthur's Point Protection Society, or Mr. Street, one or the other or both, because the change or the appeals on the noise standard for helicopters was part of that appeal and that mediation process. So the consent, we'll get that consent order before the hearings panel so they can see what changes have rolled out from mediation.
Well, given that what's going to happen with that late submission is there's going to be a standalone Section 42A report, I wonder if the smart play is to attach that consent order to that one-off 42A report. So it stays with the matter to which it's directly relevant. I think we've got enough to be going on with otherwise.
Top 12, natural hazards chapter, the consent order has been issued. And topic 18, rural zone, has been filed with the exception of the landscape assessment matters. And my understanding is that there's two appeal points, or around two issues in relation to the activity status for activities on the surface of lakes and rivers. There might be more, but that's my memory at this point. There's about at least half a dozen subtopics in that chapter, so we'll confirm that as we hand it to the hearings panel. And topic 19 has been filed, which is scarier subzones. Topic 22, which is the Jack's Point special zone. And we have consent order on minor amendments, including amendments to the structure plan, but there's still some outstanding matters in relation to home sites and the astounding natural landscapes portion of Jack's Point that's proceeding to a hearing.
Mr. Barr, looking down that list, if we put aside the informal airports, as you've said, that's relevant to Arthur's Point, my reaction is that the only ones that we need to worry about for the purpose of this hearing are going to be natural hazards, which we already have somewhere. I think Mr. Place has given us a copy of that. And he's given us a copy, as we discussed, of the draft chapter 4. You've given us chapters 3 and 6. The only one I can see we might want to see is the rural zone. Can you think of a reason why we'd need to look at any of the others? And the subdivision one.
Yeah.
But that's more. Looking at the subdivision one's more for what it doesn't say than for what it does.
There is a late submission on the temporary activities chapter.
Yes, the vain one.
That's right. But besides that, the temporary activities chapter is that you shouldn't have a huge bearing on what we're dealing with for stage 3. So I think just to understand what changes might have been made to the perhaps the provisions they're seeking that are adopted for the rural visitor zone, which resemble the rural zone, I think we should make that available. But then subdivision, as I said before, and obviously, I think the rural zone's important to understand where that's sitting, especially in the context of the rural visitor zone submissions. And topic 3 is actually very relevant for some rezonings that where an urban extension is sought and what the relevant framework is for that.
Mr. Chair, just before we move to questions, Mr. Barr has advised me he can answer the question on the hydro.
Oh. Strike while the iron's hot. So tell me, Mr. Barr.
And this is on my memory of the operative district plan hydro generation provisions, which I hope serves me well right now. The operative hydro generation zone is actually an overlay, and it says that in the text in the operative plan. And the stage 1 proposed district plan notified the rural general zone land and replaced that. There were no submissions from Contact Energy or any other party on that overlay area, and there were no appeals. So that land that has been that is now zoned rural under the PDP. I think it can be distinguished from the balance of the operative volume B, the operative district plan zones that have not been reviewed yet. And if it helps or muddies things, the stage 1 outstanding natural feature and outstanding natural landscape boundaries were imposed over what is highly likely to be part of the hydro generation overlay, especially given that the Clipper River is in part ONF and then ONL. And that didn't seem to stop the council from both notifying those O&L boundaries and accepting recommendations on submission.
So the wage Puna provisions would apply to the implementation of the rural zone over which the hydro overlay is also placed? Is that how
it would apply?
In the same way as the O&L applies to rural activities under those rural zone provisions?
Yes, that's right. The wage Puna provisions will apply to the rural zone rural zoned land as it applies to the PDP rural zone. Where the hydro generation overlay engages, there'd be, if that was to happen at the moment, there'd obviously be a tension there, there'll be issues there. That'd be a separate set of provisions that rest in the operative plan. It's in the interest of council to obviously review the operative hydro generation overlay to see how those tensions play out. But fundamentally, the relationship between the Waiheke Puna provisions would be with the PDP rural zone.
Thank you, Mr. Barr. You're ready for questions. Commissioner Smith?
No questions at this stage.
Commissioner Munro? Mr. Dawson?
Three questions.
Certainly.
These are just some actions that you've mentioned in your evidence. Can you just tell me what progress has been made with the future development strategy or the spatial plan, where that's at?
There was consultation and workshops with stakeholder groups in November last year. My understanding is that because of the COVID-19, the council's sought to undertake additional modelling and looking at the impacts of that. And once they, perhaps for want of a better word or phrase, you could say they have a better understanding of the potential impacts of that, my understanding is that they'll be consulting that document as a draft with the general public.
Okay. So there is progress, it's just it takes time at the moment. And we've got this COVID sort of taken into account.
That's right. I think key thing that some of the projections are being revisited in light of that. Mm. So they need to understand them before they take it to a broader consultation.
Just to follow up, what's your finger in the air? Best estimate of timescale for it to emerge?
Hopefully spring.
For the additional modelling or
For consultation, but we can certainly get that checked with the people in charge of that project.
Okay.
There's two other agencies involved and that might have a bearing on when it's released.
Okay. Just one matter that I, because I wasn't involved in stage one, I just struggled to get my head around. It's to do with, I think we've got some evidence regarding the rural character landscape and the rural zones and the exclusion zones. I'll deal with that when that comes up. But is it correct? Or am I correct in thinking that the outstanding natural landscapes remain, and features, remain overarching over the land, irrespective of whether they become part of an exclusion zone?
Yes.
Yeah. But that's not the case now with the RCLs?
Yes.
Okay. Right, thank you for that. And then you cover some rezoning principles in your evidence, which are referred to by several of the witnesses. Just again, because I hadn't been involved, where have they come from? Have they come out of previous decisions on other stages on the PDP?
These were initially used in the council offices for hearing streams 12 and 13, which were the Upper Clutha and Waikato Basin areas, respectively. Council offices produced a similar looking strategic overview report and included those principles. The hearings panel in some of it, in at least the introductory reports for those hearing streams, also commented on and discussed those, and I think they, I think the hearings panel recommendations also elaborated on or emphasised what components they were important in. Probably also discussed them in terms of the colonial vineyards test as well, in relationship for those principles in relation to that, which is obviously a firmer, sort of more statutory benchmark.
So that would be in the introductory reports from the decision on the recommendation reports from streams 12 and 13, did you say?
Yes.
My recollection is it's mainly in stream 13 introductory report.
The Queenstown ward?
Yeah. Mr. Hill.
Sorry, that was just the same, similar question. It's really a follow-up one in terms of those principles. Mr. Robinson might be able to help. So in terms of those reports, were those principles upheld in terms of the committee's recommendations? I mean, how much can we rely on them? Have they been upheld essentially through the decision-making process, the last decision-making process?
Yeah, I think the short answer is yes to that, sir.
That's good.
Mr. McLeod. Just a small aside, but the High Court appeal that was discontinued with the applicant, and I'm assuming that the council's going ahead with that. It's all review. I was wondering what time frames of that.
It's really safe to say. Yeah, I think it's safe to. As part of that agreement, the council's agreed to commence the identification of priority areas and scheduling of the values and capacity in the Upper Clutha within 2 months of the date of that agreement. So that's probably about a month from now is to commence that body of work. Okay. So the work's essentially starting.
Sorry, I'll just jump in if you don't mind. We need to wait for decisions from the Environment Court before any work on that can be done. So, one of the steps, the next step in terms of the topic to work is that the council needs to propose priority areas for the ONLs and Fs and the Upper Clutha RCL, so they're two separate work streams, to the court. Other parties have an opportunity to comment on it. We're consulting with parties today or this week. The court will then, I suspect, issue a decision or direction on what are to be priority areas in the ONL and F. Following that, the court has already directed that certain experts in front of the Topic 2 hearing will participate in expert conferencing. So that's planners and landscape architects. And they have four jobs. They need to come up with strategic policies which will set out how the council goes about its landscape assessment of the ONLs and Fs and of the Upper Clutha RCL. And they're two slightly different projects given the nature of the landscapes in question. So there'll be separate sets of strategic policies for those work streams. Then the planners also need to caucus on two other sets of strategic policies. One is to do with future monitoring of the rural areas of the plan, which came through the Topic 2 hearing and decision. And then the third is essentially a landscape methodology which will go into the plan. What that is about is how a landscape architect is to look at a certain resource consent application or a notice of requirement and undertake their particular landscape assessment. So that is the outputs of, that's what we need to work through. Then I anticipate I think the judge has already said that he'll give parties an opportunity to provide legal submissions on the output of that conferencing. and then we will get a decision. When we get that decision and it's beyond appeal, that's when the council actually knows and has a very clear view of how that landscape assessment will have to be undertaken. Until we get that, the council cannot start that work. I can confirm that the council is certainly looking at it, has engaged its experts, it's looking at it, it's ready to go, but until we have those strategic policies in Chapter 3 of the PDP, we're in a bit of a vacuum.
Is the reality that it could start, but it wouldn't be sensible to do so?
That's correct.
Until, because somebody's going to second-guess the methodology.
Yeah, and the 2 months mentioned is from the date of the Environment Court's decision.
Yeah, it's probably giving the insight into when will council start working on this instead of putting it away for 18 months.
Yeah.
It's that was the statutory work that needs to be completed to put the framework into the district plan.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of the council physically commencing that work, it's essentially looking at it in about 2 months about starting that work, and that includes monitoring and updating its rural building platforms. So my answer was more about the internal response to that outcome versus the what the Environment Court's directed the council to do.
Yeah.
So to quote my learned colleague, if you would put a finger in the air, that's the term. And best guess about that process flowing to, and just looking at some of the submissions that we put on this, what's the sort of time frame of that process?
It's happening now, spring. Again, the council are very keen to complete the Topic 2 process and have a Chapter 3 of the PDP is confirmed. So this early summer and spring, we'd like to have those actions completed.
Thank you.
So it's a priority of the council to try and advance this work as soon as it can. We just need to make sure we are doing it in the way that the court is expecting it to happen.
Council has many priorities.
It does.
And they should all be done in the way the court wants them to be done.
This particular one.
Commissioner Cheatham, I have more than a few questions. So Mr. Barr can explain to me what all these orders actually mean. So we'll take the lunch adjournment. How long, Kat? Well, we'll be back on the stroke of 2:00.